You know, I can remember a time when you went out of your way not to kill Mags. That was before.
Grant's voice held an ominous note, silently warning Kane not to pursue the subject. Kane ignored the warning.
Before what?
Before they attacked New Edo.
Even though Grant couldn't see him, Kane nodded in understanding. A magistrate is virtuous in the performance of his duty. The panegyric phrase drifted through his mind. The duties and obligations that came with the badge and blaster were drilled into him, all magistrates for that matter, from the day he first entered the academy. The oath was a part of a mag's every action and reaction, a justification and a reason to live, a moral sword and a shield for the work he performed to maintain order in service to the Baron. And, as Kane and Grant learned, in service to a lie, a conspiracy to manipulate that was hatched hundreds of years before any of them were born. Kane banked his manta, looking toward the line of buildings and ruins. His HUD registered no signatures of any sort, no motion, mass, or thermal.
It doesn't seem like they're scrambling another interception committee.
Under the circumstances, would you?
Assuming the question was rhetorical, Kane didn't bother with an answer. The security forces of Dreamland were more than equipped to contend with interlopers of the kind who had arrived by truck, but he was certain none of the planners had anticipated an assault from above, particularly not of the kind of craft he and Grant piloted. He wondered briefly if the irony was lost on the people who occupied the vast installation. 200 years before, the Dreamland complex was where America's most advanced weaponry and aircraft were developed. Most of America's top-secret aircraft were rolled from the hidden hangars of the Area 51 complex.
What do you want to do about the slaggers?
Kane made a slow, low pass, glancing down at the wag below him, and the people huddling around and beneath it. He counted at least 11 people in the bed of the truck, several of them children.
Not all of them are slaggers. Let's sit down and put on our act for the ones who are.
Engaging the vectored thrust ramjets, Kane and Grant dropped their mantas straight down and gracefully brought them to rest on the extended tripod landing gear. Fine clouds of dust puffed up all around. The two men opened the seals of their helmets and unlatched the cockpit canopies. Sliding them back, they climbed out of the TAVs, and shoulder to shoulder they marched toward the wag. Kane arranged his expression into a grim, foreboding scowl, knowing the image he and Grant presented was likely to be far more frightening than that of the magistrates. A very tall, very broad-shouldered man, Grant's heavy brows were drawn, shadowing his dark eyes. A fierce, down-sweeping mustache showed jet black against his coffee-brown skin. Gray showed at the temples of his short hair, as if sprinkled there by a diffident hand. His heavy-jawed face was set in a threatening scowl. At an inch over 6 feet, Kane was not as tall or as broad as Grant, but every line of his supple, compact body was hard and stripped of excess flesh. He looked like a warrior, from the hawk-like set of his head on his corded neck to the square shoulders and the lean hips and long legs. Kane was built with the savage economy of a gray wolf, with most of his muscle mass in his upper body. His high-planed face held a grim expression, as did his narrowed, gray-blue eyes. A faint scar showed like a white thread against the sun-bronzed skin of his left cheek. As different as Grant and Kane were physically, they were clad identically. From throat to fingertip to heel, they wore one-piece black leathery garments that fit as tightly as doeskin gloves. Kane had christened the garments shadow suits. The suits were almost impossible to tear, but a heavy enough bullet could penetrate them, and unlike the mag exoskeletons, wouldn't redistribute the kinetic shock. Although they rarely wore the armor any longer, they still carried their sin-eaters, strapped to holsters on their right arms. Sensitive actuators attached to the weapons popped the sin-eaters down into their waiting hands when they flexed their wrist tendons in the right sequence, putting the pistols there in an eye blink. There was no trigger guard, and when the firing stud came in contact with their crooked trigger fingers, the pistols fired immediately. They unleathered their weapons, keeping their index fingers straight. The sin-eaters slapped solidly into their palms as they approached the wag, walking on either side of the dragon's teeth obstacles. Kane looked at the truck with an appraising, critical eye. Despite the dented, rusted-out bodywork, it appeared to be in reasonably good condition, at least compared to some of the other wired-together rattle-traps he had seen elsewhere in the Outlands. Ever since the long winter of Skydark, motorized transport had been at a premium. The metalworking skills were still available for mechanical repairs of vehicles, but making tires and finding fuel was a lot more difficult. Gasoline that even remotely approached the quality of pre-dark supplies was almost non-existent anywhere but in the Vills. There were a few crude processing plants down along the Gulf Coast of Texas, a few more in Oklahoma, but the product certainly wasn't cheap, and just as certainly it was barely acceptable as fuel. He and Grant came to a halt in front of the truck, noting with amusement the number of feet visible just beneath the frame.
All you slaggers, out here where we can see you. Now.
Slowly, reluctantly, with a great deal of rustling and fumbling, people began crawling out from beneath the chassis of the dump truck. They were of a type that both Kane and Grant had no problem recognizing. Almost all of them had a scrawny, undernourished look, with sharp features and lank hair. Their hands were calloused, the fingers blunt and short-nailed. Most of them appeared to be around 40 years of age, which probably made them closer to 25. All in all, they looked like typical Outlander trash. In the Outlands, people were divided into small, regional units. Communications were stifled, rivalries bred, education impeded. The people who lived outside the direct influence of the Vills, who worked the farms, toiled in the fields, or simply roamed from place to place, were reviled and hated. They were the outcasts of the new feudalism, the cheap, expendable labor forces, even the cannon fodder when circumstances warranted. Generations of Americans were born into serfdom, slavery in everything but name. Whatever their parents or grandparents had been before Skydark, they were now only commodities of one sort or another. Begrimed and wearing tattered coveralls, the scavengers stood around the wag, all of them raising their hands without having been ordered to do so.
Which one of you is the boss of this shit-smelling outfit?
No one spoke, but several men shuffled away from a tall, broadly built man, casting him surreptitious sideways glances. A second later, Kane realized the man was actually a singularly unprepossessing woman with coarse features, short, wiry hair, and tobacco-stained teeth.
So you're in charge?
The woman inclined her head forward a fraction of an inch, a motion Grant assumed was a nod.
What's your name?
She tried twice before she was able to tell him.
Mary Lou McSween. They call me Mayor.
A wizened, sun-browned rat of a man standing near her did a poor job of repressing a snicker.
Something amuses you, slag-ass?
The man didn't seem the least bit offended or intimidated.
We call her other things, too.
Even as pale from fright as she was, Kane saw how a flush of anger reddened Mare's face, from the base of her neck to the roots of her hair. He wasn't inclined to enter into a dialogue with any of the scavengers, so he didn't respond to the little man's comment.
We call all of you other things, too. Scum, traitors, turds with legs. We know what you're doing here. But do you know why?
Nobody spoke, although a couple of them exchanged puzzled glances with one another.
I ask you a question.
Selling merchandise. That's what we do. We're salvagers.
Grant's lips worked and he spit in the dust at Mare's booted feet.
You're scavengers. Salvagers don't sell human beings. That's what you're doing. Do you know why?
Not waiting for an answer, even if one had been forthcoming, Grant strode up to Mare and grabbed her by the back of the neck. Although she winced at the painful pressure of his grasp, she didn't cry out. He forced her ahead of him alongside the truck, using her body as a wedge to push men out of the way. At the rear of the wag, he jerked down the tailgate. The people huddled together on the bed stared at him with glazed eyes. The glassy sheen told Grant they had been drugged by some sort of soporific, but a couple of the men looked as if their faculties were returning. They were sufficiently alert to be frightened of him, at any rate. Grant could easily guess the kind of thoughts wheeling through the minds of the prisoners, and he couldn't blame them for being too scared to speak. His and Kane's work with the Cerberus exiles always kept them in a shadowy world of danger and eternal suspicion, of sudden crisis and alarm, where human beings died in a covert war that ranged from a subterranean lair beneath New Mexico to the utter remoteness of a forgotten colony on the moon. Grant tightened his grip on the back of Mayor McSween's neck.
You were going to sell your fellow human beings like they were cattle, so they could be harvested. Their blood drained, their bodies cut open, their guts unwound, all their organs, glands, and even bone marrow removed and processed. All to keep the barons alive.
Mare's eyes widened.
Barons?
Barons. They need human blood and guts to survive, so they set up a processing center here in Groom Lake. That's the why of it.
I didn't know.
you didn't know. And if you had, you wouldn't have given a shit.
Grant dragged her away from the truck and released her, pushing her away from him. She stumbled a few paces, but didn't fall. He swept her and her men with a furious glare.
Now the barons can have you if they want.
Grant turned toward the prisoners.
Do any of you know how to drive?
For a long moment, the people just stared at him blankly, as if he had addressed them in a foreign language. Then a black man with wild hair resembling lengths of tarred wire spoke tentatively.
Been a long time, but I think I can manage.
Good. Get in and get the hell out of here. As fast as you can, and don't stop for anything.
Mare raised her voice in a feeble protest.
You can't just take my wagon and leave us out here!
Grant whirled on her, lifting his sin-eater and holding it out at the end of his extended arm. The boar touched the woman's forehead, and she squeezed her eyes shut. Kane tensed, unconsciously holding his breath. Grant was not putting on an act now. The big man could barely restrain himself from depressing the trigger stud and blowing the scavenger chief's brains out. Grant growled, lips peeled back from his teeth in a silent snarl.
Not another word. Not even a sound.
The woman opened her eyes and swallowed hard. She obeyed Grant's edict to make no sound, but Kane caught a strange flicker of emotion in her eyes. He couldn't be certain, but he received the impression the woman felt relief at having the prisoner set free. The black man climbed up into the cab and slid behind the wheel. He turned the key, and the engine caught on the first try. He ground the clutch, yanked back on the stick shift, and floored the accelerator. Within moments, the roar of the engine and the squeak of the suspension faded away. The little man who had snickered earlier spoke beseechingly.
How are we gonna get out of here?
The corner of Kane's mouth quirked in a mirthless smile.
What makes you think we care how you do it, or even if?
Grant gestured to the variety of weapons scattered on the ground.
You can keep your blasters. Not that they'll do you much good if more mags and birds come out. And I'm pretty sure they will once we're gone.
The man made a move to scoop up a fallen rifle. The rifle went spinning across the ground, its stock a ruin of wood. The man scuttled backward, shocked and amazed.
You can have them after we're out of back-shooting range.
Grant dismissively turned his back on Mare and her crew and spoke to Kane as he stalked away.
I'm done here.
Me too.
Rather than emulate his partner's display of contemptuous confidence, Kane backstepped, keeping his pistol trained on the scavengers. He didn't really expect any of them to grab up a gun and start shooting, but he figured it was safer not to give them the option. When the Dragon's Teeth obstacles were between them and the scavenger gang, Kane felt safe enough to start walking normally and to lower his sin-eater. He didn't holster it. Not too long before, he had been jumped by a couple of vicious ferrers, one of them armed with only a pipe. It didn't pay to underestimate the murderous impulses of outland slaggers. Even though they'd been terrorized, humiliated, robbed, and now left to fend for themselves in exceptionally hostile territory, Kane would not have been surprised if they decided to throw a few parting pieces of lead their way. When the two men reached their manta ships, the sharp report of a shot reached them. Grant and Kane spun, reflexively dropping into crouches, their sin-eaters questing for targets. They heard no more shots, but a confused babble of outraged voices arose from where they had left the group of scavengers. Carefully, both men straightened. They saw a man lying spread-eagled on his back, with Mare standing over him, wielding a rifle. The man's face was awash with wet scarlet. Mare screeched, infuriated to the point of madness.
There's your finder's fee, squint!
There's more to that story than meets the eye.
Grant lifted the broad yoke of his shoulders in a negligent shrug.
Whatever it was, Mary Lou wrote a finis to it.
He sighed wearily and shook his head.
If they're a hell of a lot luckier than they deserve to be, they might make it out of here without replacing the merchandise we set loose.
Kane glanced toward the distant structures miles across the lake bed, all laid out against the gray ribbon of an extremely long runway, the longest one in the pre-dark world, he had been told. A line of compacted rubble still stood above ground. The place looked the same as it did when Kane had first seen it, more than 6 months before. Godforsaken. He saw no sign of activity in the rubble or around the monstrous hangar, but he had no trouble imagining the panic and chaos erupting beneath the lake bed. Whether any barons were presently in the installation was immaterial. There were plenty of hybrids, and he knew all of them retained vivid memories of the last time he and Grant had visited a processing center, or, for that matter, the last time the two of them had been in Area 51. Sweeping his gaze over the burning wreckage of the Deathbirds and the Sandcat, Kane felt no genuine sense of satisfaction about the relative ease of the victory.
I'm kind of surprised they haven't sent out more birds, if nothing else.
Grant frowned.
They're watching us, trying to figure us out. They used their conventional security measures and got their asses kicked. They won't make the same mistake twice. And I'm just as glad.
Grant nodded to the shiny bullet-inflicted scars on the wing of Kane's Manta.
We're low on missiles and cannon rounds. I'd rather not waste what we have left on another dogfight. We made our point.
And then some. Not to mention, we found out these ships operate in an atmosphere just as well as they do in outer space.
He heaved himself up on the wing of his tab.
Race you back home.
Grant shook his head.
Not going home. At least not right away.
Kane eyed him suspiciously.
You got some other destination for us in mind?
Grant levered his body atop his Manta's wing.
For me, anyhow. Nuedo.
I'm not surprised. And how long do you figure you'll be gone?
Grant dropped into the cockpit and strapped himself into the pilot's seat.
Until I come back?
Kane nodded as if Grant's deliberately cryptic reply explained everything.
I'm not sure if this has occurred to you or not, but we don't know everything there is to know about these ships. You could stall out over the Pacific.
Grant's teeth flashed in a grin.
We flew these crates down from the moon, Kane. I think that's enough of a shakedown flight, don't you? Besides, I think the only reason you're bringing that up at all is you don't want to go back to Cerberus by yourself. Not that I really blame you under the circumstances.
Kane's eyebrows knitted in a scowl, then he grinned ruefully.
I could probably argue, but you're pretty much on target. Give my regards to Shizuka.
Will do.
Kane decided to stay grounded until Grant was airborne, just in case more death birds were dispatched. With a droning whine, the Manta slowly rose, a small and brief hurricane of dust swirling beneath it. Grant stopped the ship's ascent at 200 feet, and he waggled its wings in a farewell. Then he engaged the pulse detonation wave engines, and the Manta raced across the sky like a bullet hurtling up the barrel of a gun. The columns of smoke from the destroyed death birds were sucked toward the updraft. The trailing sonic boom slammed its thunderclap above Groom Lake. Kane felt the concussion running through the hull of his ship. He climbed down into the cockpit, once again surprised by the simplicity of the instrument panel. The controls consisted primarily of a joystick, altimeter, and fuel gauges. He slipped the helmet over his head and heard the buzz of its internal power source juicing up immediately. The interior curve of the helmet's visor swarmed with a squall of glowing pixels. When they cleared a nanosecond later, he had CGI icons of sensor scopes, range finders, and various indicators. The ship's real controls were all computerized, reduced to microprocessors within the helmet itself. Kane felt a pressure shifting around the base of his neck as the helmet automatically extended a lining and a seal. He heard the hiss and cool breath of oxygen pumped from the tanks mounted on the back of the chair. Closing his hand around the joystick, he pulled it back slightly, then pushed it forward. It caught and clicked into position. The hull began to vibrate around him, in tandem with a whine that grew in pitch. On the inside of his helmet flashed the words, VTOL launch system enabled. With a stomach-sinking swiftness, the Manta lifted off the ground. The helmet's HUD displays offered different vantage points of the ascent, and Kane's eyes flicked from one to another. He watched as the dry lake basin and the line of rubble receded so quickly they became mere ripples of contrasting texture and color. High mountain peaks appeared, then shrank into little snow-capped cones. Kane pulled back on the control stick, and the inventory of all the dials, switches, gauges, and fire controls flashed across the helmet's visor. He started to engage the pulse detonation wave engines, then thought about who was waiting for him back at the Cerberus Redoubt. He decided he wasn't in that much of a hurry. Matic was less unhappy about the loss of Dreamland ordnance and personnel than he was about losing the game of rock-scissors-paper to Brodeur. That meant it fell to him to brief the current Baron in residence. He stood in a large room lined with two aisles of computer stations. He and Brodeur faced a huge flat-screen vid monitor that covered the far wall. The screen was divided into small square sections, each one showing different black-and-white views of the lake bed. The range of the old vid spy eyes wasn't sufficient to transmit more than suggestions of detail, but Matic recognized destruction when he saw it. As a survivor of the Dulce disaster, he was intimately familiar with devastation of various sorts. and though he wasn't intimately familiar with the men who had brought on the destruction in New Mexico, he was fairly certain that both Kane and Grant piloted the strange airships that had wreaked such havoc in so short a time. Brodeur's fingers pressed a button on the console, and images on the monitor screen sped up. Flames licked crazily from the Sandcat and the Deathbird. The airships landed nearby, and two men in black climbed out of them. All the motions were sped up to an inhuman tempo. Matic gestured.
Freeze it there.
The quality of the image was poor, but Matic was able to recognize Grant and Kane as they strode toward the wag parked at the edge of the lake bed. He didn't feel satisfied that his guess was correct, since the conclusion was obvious. Only the pair of renegade magistrates from Cobaltville possessed the sheer audacity to stage a daylight attack literally at the front door of the new processing and treatment center. Besides, he was sure Kane still held more than a passing grudge because of his weeks of captivity in Dreamland. Matic and Brodeur had been instrumental in his escape, as well as helping to displace Baron Cobalt's troops from the installation. But that didn't mean Kane or his friends would necessarily cede either of them a special dispensation when next they met.
Grant and Kane. Nervy bastards coming back here. Nervy, but they had a hell of an ace to play. All of our ordnance was completely outclassed. Where the fuck did they get those crates? I never saw anything like them. They're not like the old fighter jets I've seen pics of. I don't know. They must have resources we never heard about from Domi. But it took them long enough to trot them out. They weren't trying to flash blast this place. They were sending the Imperator and the Barons a message. Yeah, I wonder how they'll take it. I don't even want to think about it.
Roger replayed the vid record of the Sandcat exploding.
Who was in the cat? I don't know. Probably some of Baron Sharp's men. I wish he was here instead of her. Sharp's fused out, but there's something really, I don't know, evil about her. Aren't you a little worried that she might find out what you were up to with Quavel? Not a little, a lot. But it's been over a month since she left, and none of the Barons has asked me anything about her. Yeah, makes me wonder if they don't already know everything there is to know. I thought you'd learn that the Barons aren't gods. That doesn't make them any less dangerous. They're still in charge, and we still have to report to them. 2 out of 3? In your dreams. You'd better stop stalling and go tell her. Some friend you are.
He squared his shoulders and left the room. He walked down a broad corridor, lit from above by neon strips, paused at a checkpoint, and used his keycard to open the door that led to the monorail platform. On the other side of it lay a multi-leveled man-made cavern. The dimensions were so vast, the far end ran away into the dimness. The ceiling was at least 300 feet above his head and dotted with bright stadium lights. Large containers were arranged in orderly 50-foot-tall aisles, stretching as far as he could see. Gently sloping ramps led from level to level, broad, flat passages for lift trucks and dollies to carry their loads. The ramps were the only method of getting from level to level. As always, the vast chamber was a beehive of activity, with forklifts moving to and fro, laden with boxes, and the small shifter engines of the monorail train zipping back and forth. The area was far, far larger than the biggest chamber beneath Archuleta Mesa. Not that Matic had been in every chamber in the installation outside of Dulce, New Mexico. If nothing else about the assignment, he was free to go anywhere he wished in Dreamland. A high, musical voice called out from behind him.
Matic, may I speak with you?
Matic turned and saw a female hybrid standing at the mouth of a maintenance access way. Her name was Lailana. And like all of her kind, she was excessively slender and small of stature, less than 5 feet tall. Her compact form was encased in a silver-gray, skin-tight bodysuit, the duty uniform of her people. Her face showed pale as new gold, with the darker masses of her silky brown hair picking up the same tint and turning it to bronze. Above prominent cheekbones, huge, upslanting eyes of tawny gold-brown regarded him in a silent appraisal. Aware of the vid spy eye clamped to the ceiling, Matic kept his expression neutral as he walked toward the accessway. Once he was inside, Lailana threw herself into his arms. She stood on tiptoe, and he bent at the knees so their lips could meet. Her tongue darted into his mouth, and after a moment, Matic pushed her away. In such a small space, the only trap deadlier than a crossfire was a compromising position.
Not now. I've got to report to the Baron.
Lailana gazed up at him, her dark gaze unfathomable yet somehow reproachful.
It's been days since we were together.
And we've just been attacked.
I heard no alarms.
Because it was a sneak attack. We had no warning. They're gone now. No point in sounding a general alert.
Who attacked us?
I can't be sure, but I think the perpetrators were Grant and Kane.
Lalana's face didn't lose its mask-like placidity, but Maddock knew the mention of Kane would instantly bring unpleasant memories to the forefront of her mind. He didn't want to cause her pain by reminding her of the man who had killed her former lover, but he wanted her to focus her wits on something other than a repetition of their clandestine meeting in the same place 3 days before.
Kane. Always Kane.
Do you want revenge?
Lalana looked up at him, a corner of her mouth quirking in a scornful smile.
Revenge indeed. He killed Hank before my eyes. Then only 2 hours later, Baron Cobalt forced me to copulate with him. No, not revenge against Kane. Retribution. A reckoning. But if Baron Cobalt was still here, I might consider exacting vengeance against him. And do you not wish retribution of some sort? Your beloved Quavel left you to be with Kane, or so it is believed.
I wouldn't call her my beloved. She carries Kane's child, as you and all the females here were intended to. I don't want revenge or retribution. I just hope she's safe.
He made a move to leave the access way, but Lailana caught him by the hand.
You are not offended?
Maddock smiled down at her wryly.
No, but I am in a hurry.
No more so than I, my beautiful apeling.
Forcing a chuckle, he disengaged himself and returned to the monorail platform just as the engine pulled up with a soft electric hum. Maddock climbed into the passenger car and fished out his comm from a pocket of his zippered coverall. The monorail system was the only way to move efficiently around the many and widely separated sections of the Area 51 installation. Maddock spoke into the comm unit.
Green, go.
Without the proper code recognition words, the controllers would not feed power to the rail. The engine's hum rose in pitch, and with a slight lurch, the train slid almost silently along the rail. It swiftly built up speed. Overhead light fixtures flicked by so rapidly that they combined with the intervals of darkness between them to acquire a strobing pattern. Thinking of Quavel, Maddock repressed a sigh. Quavel had performed excellently as a spy within the complex during Baron Cobalt's brief occupation of Area 51. If not for the intelligence she provided to Baron Sharp and Sumerium and her organization of a fifth column among the installation's personnel, Dreamland would never have been wrested away from Baron Cobalt and his forces. Betraying a Baron was something he never expected from either a hybrid or himself. But, he reminded himself sourly, he never expected to fall in love with a hybrid either. He hadn't even known such a people existed until a year ago. Back then, he was the newest member of the Archuleta Mesa Security Force, recruited from the ranks of freshly badged magistrates in Cobaltville. At the time, he wasn't certain if the assignment was superior to walking pedestrian patrol in the Tartarus pits. At least, in the pits, he had known what to expect, understood the kind of people he would be dealing with. Slaggers, mainly, since that sector of Cobaltville was a melting pot of cheap labor, petty criminals, and outlanders. The Archuleta Mesa duty was like nothing he had expected or even imagined. The high level of technology in use in the installation came as more than a surprise. It was profoundly shocking. Machines, wags, and devices of all types far outstripped anything in Cobaltville. And if he thought some of the pitters were strange, the permanent personnel in the subterranean complex made them seem mundane and colorless in comparison. None of the security force dealt directly with the slightly built, delicate-featured people. They were segregated from them, although each of the four sex squads had a designated intermediary who conveyed their orders. The people, if that's what they were, spooked Maddock, made his skin crawl and his short hair tingle on his scalp. He had only caught glimpses of them from time to time, and they struck him as more than human, but at the same time somehow other than human, too. All shared similar characteristics besides slender, almost childish builds, large domed heads, huge slanting eyes, and faces that seemed all brow ridges and cheekbones. He had seen a couple of them walking around with plastic tube-shaped holsters strapped to their thighs. Shortly after arriving at the Mesa, he asked a fellow sec guard if the people were a breed of mutie. Since the man also hailed from Cobaltville, he figured he'd share his curiosity, especially after he pointed out to him how the small, big-headed people didn't fit any of the descriptions of stickies, scalies, swampies, or scabbies he had ever heard of. The man's response was cold and to the point.
The desert is full of the bones of stoops like you who started asking questions about this place.
Maddock immediately ceased further inquiries. Shortly thereafter, his duties ceased too, when the installation was destroyed. Later, he learned Kane, Grant, and a couple of other renegades were responsible. Even at that point, the former magistrates had become figures of inspiration to the disenfranchised, to the Outlander. Their acts of sabotage triggered sporadic rebellions in the Outlands. True enough, they weren't organized uprisings, but their frequency was of a kind not seen in 90 years, since the days of the Baron Blasters who opposed the program of unification. The monorail curved lazily to the right, plunging almost noiselessly into a side chute. Lights shone intermittently on the smooth walls, small drops of illumination that did little to alleviate the deep shadows. The train's speed dropped, and it hissed to a halt beside a broad platform. He climbed out and strode along a featureless expanse of corridor, the walls made of mortared, unpainted concrete blocks. He passed several closed, electronic lock-equipped doors, each one bearing the circular yellow and black radiation warning symbol. Beneath the symbols were plastic signs emblazoned with block-red lettering. Radiation hazard beyond this point. Entry forbidden to personnel not wearing anti-contaminant clothing. Maddock ignored the warning, knowing it dated back to pre-dark days. When he reached a T-branching intersection, Maddock walked to a door without the symbol or the warnings, although it held a small plaque that read Purity Control Orientation. He recalled what Quavel had told him about the meaning of the term. Everyone selected for Fulville citizenship in the baronies and for permission to reproduce had to meet a strict criteria. The actual but concealed reason was simple. The purer the quality of individual genetic characteristics, the purer the quality of the hybrid. The practice was called purity control. Even members of the baronial oligarchy, the self-proclaimed homo superior, were bred from this system. However, with the destruction of the Archuleta Mesa medical facilities, without access to the ectogenesis techniques of fetal development outside the womb, the oligarchy and the entire hybrid race were in danger of extinction. Baron Cobalt occupied Area 51 with the spoken assumption of taking responsibility to sustain his race, but only if he was elevated to a position of high authority, even above his brother barons. It wasn't a matter of making an incursion into another baron's territory, since most of Nevada was an outland flat zone, not a part of an official baronial territory, certainly not Baron Cobalt's. Since Area 51's history was intertwined with rumors of alien involvement, Baron Cobalt had used its medical facilities as a substitute for those destroyed in New Mexico. He reactivated the installation, turning it into a processing and treatment center, without having to rebuild from scratch. He transferred the surviving human and hybrid personnel from the Dulce facility. In severe cases, even damaged organs were replaced from the storage banks of organic material stockpiled there. Still and all, the medical treatments that addressed the congenital autoimmune system deficiencies of the hybrids weren't enough to ensure the continued survival of the race. The necessary equipment and raw material to implement procreation had yet to be installed. Baron Cobalt had unilaterally decided that the conventional means of conception was the only option to keep the hybrid race alive. Cobalt's command for the female hybrids to commit acts of miscegenation with human males was one thing, perhaps even forgivable under the circumstances. When he dangled the treatments before his fellow barons like a carrot on a string rather than sharing them freely, war was the inevitable result. Although Area 51, Dreamland, was known in pre-dark legends for the testing and development of advanced technology, it had also served as an international base operated by a consortium from many countries. Over the past 6 months, a program had been implemented to have its operation overseen by a consortium of barons, which in turn would be overseen by the Imperator. The ancient Roman Empire was governed by a Senate, but ruled by an emperor, sometimes known as an imperator. This person served as the final arbiter in matters pertaining to government. The Vills acted interdependently, unified in name only. 6 months before, during a council of the barons in Front Royal, Baron Cobalt put forth the proposal to establish a central ruling consortium. In effect, the barons would become viceroys, plenipotentiaries, in their own territories. The barons were less in favor of the concept than Baron Cobalt's proclamation that he be recognized as the Imperator. Their displeasure didn't last, since the proposal and title was appropriated by another. The door opened into a medium-sized office suite, with 6 partition-enclosed desks, all of them equipped with computer terminals. Tacked on the wall, faded and yellowed with age, were large full-color illustrations, a sequence of which ran nearly the entire length of the wall. The pictures displayed images of a naked human male and female, superimposed over twisting DNA molecules. The next illustration showed the strands of the helix separated, then moved back together in a new chain configuration. Another image showed egg cells being opened by microscalpels so their dark nuclei could be replaced with new ones. The final picture showed the male and female holding the hands of a baby standing between them. The baby possessed a very high forehead and domed cranium above pronounced brow arches overhanging big, slanting, staring eyes. Maddock repressed a shudder as he passed the illustrations. He entered a doorway on the far side of the room, walking into a high-ceilinged chamber and past a series of cubicles adjoined by partitions. He didn't walk far before he reached the treatment area and came to a halt. Maddock had seen pictures of ancient Egyptian sarcophagi, and the object propped up against a cross-barred brace looked very much like one, except it appeared to be molded from some transparent polymer. 2 flexible hoses were connected to it at opposing midway points. The hoses, in turn, were connected to a metal tank with 2 valve wheels projecting from the top. Within the sarcophagus, submerged up to her neck in a brown-hued fluid, was a naked female figure. With her head tilted back, her perfectly formed aquiline features composed, and with her huge eyes closed, Baron Beausoleil looked like a beautifully crafted statue. Maddock noticed the slight rise and fall of her lithe breasts, and he felt a stirring in his groin. He was both astonished and not a little revolted by his reaction. He remembered the first time he had met a baron, the crazy little man who ruled Sharpville, and the suffocating sense of terror he had experienced on that day. Now, he felt something akin to that same xenophobic cringing. He had never dreamed he would stand in the presence of a baron was a naked woman. Maddock had heard stories of the barons for his entire life. Anyone serving in any division in any ville had heard of them. Part of his mind knew that maintaining a baron's mystique was contrived, a psychological gambit meant to intimidate and awe. But still, the baronial oligarchy ruling the 9 villes was more than the governing body of post-Newcost America. They were god-kings, serving as a bridge between pre-dark and post-dark man, the avatars of a new order. Baron Beausoleil breathed deeply and regularly through her small nostrils. She was the only female of the oligarchy, but she also had the same wispy, duck-down textured hair as the male barons, although hers was jet black with dark coppery highlights and piled high on her head. Her male attendant gave Maddock a disinterested glance, then turned 2 wheel valves simultaneously. Almost immediately, the sarcophagus began to drain, and he stepped back, moving with a bizarrely beautiful, danceresque grace. All hybrids, male and female alike, had builds that were small, slender, and gracile. Their faces were composed of sharp planes, with fine-complexioned skin stretched tight over prominent shelves of cheekbones. The craniums were very high and smooth, the ears small and set low on the head. Their backslanting eyes were large, shadowed by sweeping supraorbital ridges. Only hair, eye color, and slight differences in height differentiated them. All in all, they were a beautiful people, almost too perfect to be real. But Maddock knew the hybrids weren't perfect, particularly the barons. Quivel had explained that although all the hybrids were extremely long-lived, cellular and metabolic deterioration was part and parcel of what they were, mixtures of human and a race called the Archons. And even though they were a biological bridge between 2 races, not even the barons were sure of the reasons behind the hybridization program. But they did know that in order to rule humans, they were dependent on the biological material their subjects provided. The hybrids, at least by their way of thinking, represented the final phase of human evolution. They created wholesale, planned alterations in living organisms and were empowered to control not only their immediate environment, but also the evolution of other species. At the pinnacle of that evolutionary achievement were the Barons, as high above hybrids like Lilana and the Attendant as the hybrids were above mere humans. A clear fluid sprayed from a nozzle, rinsing the residue of the chemical bath from Baron Beausoleil's body. When the cycle was completed, she opened her deep violet eyes and swept her calm gaze across Maddock, who stood with his hands clasped behind his back. She nodded to her attendant, who unlatched the lid of the sarcophagus and pulled it open. The faint reek of astringent compounds, mixed with the coppery tang of blood, entered his nostrils. He had no idea of the chemicals used in the gene therapy immersions, but he knew an equal measure of processed and liquefied human organic material composed the fluid. The Baron, he could not break a lifetime of conditioning and think of her as Baroness Beausoleil, stepped out and took the towel offered by her attendant. She dabbed at her limbs, but even in the indirect light, Maddock saw a few damp places on her body. It was almost as if the pores of her skin absorbed the fluid mixture. She ignored Maddock, completely at ease with her nudity. Her skin was smooth and of a marble whiteness, but with a faint olive undertone. Her small breasts were firm, her belly flat and tautly muscled. She was nearly a half-head taller than her attendant. Maddock had no idea of how old she truly was. She looked no more than 20 years of age, but she could have been as old as 80 or 90. Quavel claimed to be on the high side of 60 herself. Closer to 100, he decided, as he looked at the Baron's eyes. He shivered slightly when he realized there was no reflection in those eyes, as if they had been cut from slabs of onyx. But there was something about them that gave her the exotic flair of the Persian concubines he had seen pics of in old books. Maddock averted his gaze, being very careful not to stare at her. He had wondered why Beausoleil hadn't assumed the title of Baroness, but he supposed it had something to do with the patriarchal tradition of the ruling class. More than likely, only her personal staff in her ville knew she was female. The attendant stepped forward, holding out a brocade robe. Baron Beausoleil slid her slender arms into the belled sleeves of the robe, but made no move to close it. Maddock kept his eyes cast to one side and down. She spoke in a throaty voice, purring with amusement.
"Why are you here?"
Maddock looked at her out of the corner of an eye.
"There was an incident above, my lord."
"An incident? Explain."
Doing his utmost not to stammer or appear to grope for words, Maddock related everything that had happened topside, beginning with the report transcommed in from the Deathbird Patrol regarding the arrival of merchandise to the outcome of the aerial battle. Baron Beausoleil's expression remained studiedly neutral throughout the report, as if Maddock were recounting a list of laundry yet to be washed. When he was done, he fell silent and waited. The Baron remained just as silent, regarding him with her big eyes, but not really looking at him. Maddock had witnessed similar non-reactions among the hybrids in the installation, and he knew the silence and distant stare meant she was processing the information, examining the possible consequences, and extrapolating on the results of all the available choices. He wasn't sure if he preferred her contemplative silence to a screaming tantrum. A violent reaction would have at least indicated she felt an emotion he could relate to, even if it were only outrage. When they experienced emotions, they only did so in moments of stress, and then so intensely they were almost consumed by them. However, Quavel had warned him that if he were in the company of a baron who was overwhelmed by emotion, particularly a negative one, then his death would be sure to follow.
"What of the people who arrived with the merchandise?"
"They are on foot, my lord."
"A contingent of our troops should be dispatched post-haste to apprehend them. They should be instructed to employ non-lethal force. If it becomes necessary to kill any of them, the troops should restrict their fire to headshots. We don't want the tissues or organs damaged beyond the point they are useless for recycling."
"I understand, my lord."
He turned on his heel to carry out her orders.
"I did not dismiss you."
Slowly, he turned to face her, this time lifting his gaze. Dread sent little cold prickles up and down his spine. She eyed him with a calm dispassion.
"How are you dealing with Quavel's disappearance?"
Maddock's stomach slid sideways. He had not expected such a question, certainly not from the Baron.
I don't understand.
A smile ghosted over her pale lips.
Emotionally, how are you dealing with the fact that your lover deserted you for another?
Maddox still didn't speak.
How do you feel about it?
Discussing emotions was not a topic he had ever imagined was in a Baron's repertoire. According to Quavel, the Barons were bred for brilliance and therefore had emotional limitations placed upon their enormous intellects. Therefore, their thought processes were very structured, extremely linear. Maddox placed his hands behind his back again, not so much as a sign of deference, but to hide their sudden tremor from Baron Beausoleil. He realized denying his relationship with Quavel was pointless.
I was upset, of course. But I've come to terms with it.
As you should, since you helped her to escape.
Maddox felt sweat spring to his hairline, and he was barely able to keep the surge of terror he experienced from showing on his face.
You have nothing to say to that?
The Baron's haughty smile widened, but didn't reach her eyes.
Was my lord asking a question? Or was she stating a fact?
I will leave that up to you to decide, but I still require a response.
Maddox struggled to think clearly. He found his eyes shifting from her face to the firm, hard-tipped breasts, past them to her flat, hard belly, and then to the naked juncture of her curving thighs. Despite the circumstances, he felt himself responding to the Baron's nudity. His mind raced, wheeling with fears, shame, and multiple choices. The baronies had not been conceived as participatory democracies, but with the advent of the Imperator as the puppet master of the barons, they had come to rely more and more on human counsel, as well as direct face-to-face interaction. Over the past few months, Baron Beausoleil had expanded her own influence by co-opting the human personnel of the Area 51 installation, who still swore allegiance to a particular baron, and elevating them to positions of power. The enormous complex had originally been staffed by humans and hybrids who served Baron Cobalt. Once he had been overthrown and dispossessed, his followers were neutralized, not eliminated. Although Maddox hailed from Cobaltville, he didn't give a damn about Cobalt or any of the barons. There was little point in swearing oaths of fealty to one over another, inasmuch as he had heard rumors that several of the barons had joined forces and were building effective military operations outside of Dreamland. They were waiting to combine their military might and take over Area 51 and defy the Imperator. Then, of course, being barons, they would make their own individual snatches for that title. Maddox wasn't sure if Beausoleil was among that group who plotted and schemed, or if she had her own agenda.
I'm waiting.
Quavel did not need my help to leave the installation, my lord baron.
Baron Beausoleil smiled slyly.
You're lying.
Maddox shook his head.
She knows how to drive the vehicles in storage. Because of her standing, she had no problem requisitioning one, so she did not require any aid from me.
Beausoleil uttered a low laugh and languorously stepped toward him with a feline grace.
But she required your aid in ascertaining the correct route to take to reach her destination with the minimum of danger, did she not?
Maddox said nothing.
Quavel seeks the father of her unborn child. She knows where he is. Information that has never been shared with the oligarchy, either shared by her or the Imperator.
For a second, Maddox stood frozen, his breath seizing in his lungs. The Baron sidled up against him, sliding her arms around his neck and pulling his head down. She stood on tiptoes, her lips parting, her dark eyes gazing unblinkingly into his.
During Kane's captivity here, Quavel learned the location of his nest of insurrectionists.
The sweat of tension formed on Maddox's body, and he felt the physical stirring her naked proximity and sensual voice evoked in him. He tried to ignore the presence of the attendant lurking in the shadows.
What makes you so sure of that?
Her inhumanly long fingers lightly caressed his nape. She didn't answer his question.
So she went to join him, carrying a child in her womb that could easily change the balance of power. A hybrid of a hybrid, the ultimate expression of unity between old and new human. A rallying point that could one day drown the world in blood.
Humans aren't all murderous savages, as more than one of your new human females have learned.
Despite himself, Maddock felt his body responding to her, to the musky scent and heat radiating from her body. He had difficulty breathing. Baron Beausoleil stepped back and glanced down at the jutting evidence of his arousal, straining at the crotch of his jumpsuit.
Savages. Predators all. You have been held in check because the Holocaust of 2 centuries ago called the pack. Only the strongest survived. The strongest is what I and the Imperator seek, so we may bring all the barons to heel, to call their pack, so to speak. Such an action is imminent.
Maddock swallowed hard. He couldn't believe Baron Beausoleil had confided to him the start of the long-feared clash between the disaffected barons and the forces of the Imperator. He had suspected such a plan was in the works, but he realized that even when things that were expected to happen finally did, they never happened in the expected way.
Are you one of the strongest?
She lightly traced the outline of his erection with the tip of a finger. He jerked away from her touch.
How do you know where Quavel is?
She can be tracked. It has been so with her since she was removed from her incubation chamber, decades before you were born.
If you know where she is, why hasn't a retrieval squad been sent out?
Quavel is exactly where the Imperator wants her to be. Both of you helped to expedite his strategy.
Terror struck Maddock like a closed fist slammed over his heart, but he continued to stand stock still as the Baron's fingers teased him.
Do you love her?
Maddock had no idea of how to respond. He doubted the Barons understood the concept.
Did she love you? Or did you simply lust for each other as you now lust for me?
Lust and love often seem the same, but you can have one without the other.
Baron Beausoleil shrugged as if the matter were of little importance.
So I have learned. You certainly don't love me, but you lust for me. I cannot deny I find myself intrigued by your sexual arousal. It gives me a sense of personal power. Did you experience the same sense of power when you copulated with my kind's females, and learned that some of them, your precious Quavel among them, enjoyed it? Indeed, a few began to look forward to it.
Maddock finally dredged up a modicum of angry courage.
It was Baron Cobalt's will. They followed his edicts.
Oh, Brother Cobalt turned this facility into an underground stud farm, our women into brood mares, all to find out if the conventional means of procreation between old and new human would produce offspring. Now that it has been proved, the only reason for the miscegenation to continue is to use the progeny born of these unions, if there are any more, as raw material to be processed and used to keep the oligarchy alive. Neither love nor lust has anything to do with it. And therefore you no longer need console yourself with Lailana, and she no longer need corrupt herself with you.
Lailana?
Has your desire for me driven all thoughts of her out of your mind? You human males, so proud of your muscles, so proud of your strength and your organs of reproduction. But even so, only one of you could shoot the seed with sufficient potency to produce a child.
Maddock's erection began to wilt, and Baron Beausoleil realized it. She began to turn away, her lips stretched in a contemptuous smirk.
Such cowards, too.
The Baron's unexpected kick caught Maddock in the groin. Sickening pain exploded up through his testicles. Although he didn't give Baron Beausoleil the satisfaction of hearing him cry out, he couldn't help but clutch at his crotch and fold in the direction of the white-hot agony. He fell to the floor and tried to huddle into himself, as his magistrate training had taught. Baron Beausoleil kicked him again, this time in the kidneys. And as his back arched from both the pain and the impact, she hooked her toes under his chin and forced his head back. Then she planted a heel on his throat. Through the pounding in his ears, he heard her voice, sibilant with hate and disgust.
Long, long ago, long before you were born, I decided not to rely solely on humans to protect me. I sought out the best trainers available, and though I could never develop the strength in my body to match that of an apekin, I learned all of your kind's weak and vulnerable points, and how to incapacitate you with little risk to myself.
Through pain-fogged eyes, Maddox saw Baron Beausoleil gazing down at him, her face twisted in a smile of pure, malicious triumph. He couldn't help but notice how stiffly her nipples projected. She breathed heavily, eyes glittering. Absently, he realized that Brodeur's casual description of her as evil hadn't been mere hyperbole. He glimpsed the attendant standing off to one side, his face a blank mask.
I learned during the training period that I was aroused by watching apelings grovel and beg for their lives.
Maddox's lips writhed, but all he could manage was a strangulated croak.
Won't beg.
The Baron nodded as if she had expected the response.
Then I think it's only fair for you to fulfill your magistrate's oath, to die in the service of your Baron.
You're not my Baron, you bitch.
Baron Beausoleil shrugged.
Any will do.
Killing me won't help you dominate the other Barons. You need the Apekin like me to do the dirty work. And once you kill me, you'll have a rebellion brewing here.
I won't deny I'm employing an old tactic. To make you an example, kill one and frighten all the others into submission. I learned that from the magistrate trainers, too. So your kind does have a degree of wisdom. You should be flattered that I even concede that much to humankind.
Then Baron Beausoleil stamped down, expertly putting the proper pressure in the right place to crush Maddox's trachea with her heel. Baron Beausoleil affected a swaggering, long-legged gait as she strode purposefully and barefoot down the corridor. The open robe belled out behind her like a cloak, accentuating the startling effect. As a member of an elite group bred for physical and mental perfection, she had no inhibitions about displaying her body. But she noticed that the few human males she passed turned quickly away from her. She wasn't sure if they averted their eyes to conceal the desire her beauty aroused in them, or if it was due to the baronial mystique. She didn't care one way or the other. She put them down as mental dwarfs, hopelessly stunted by their stupidity and fear. The Baron felt very good following the final gene therapy session, her energy levels restored to maximum after the week-long regimen that included infusions of blood, adenine, guanine, cytosine, and long-string protein molecules. All the biochemicals were absorbed through the pores of her skin and then into her cellular structure. She would enjoy near-perfect health for at least another year or so. There was a time, she reflected, in the very recent past, wherein the survival, let alone the health of the entire hybrid race, was cast in serious doubt. And if the baronial oligarchy believed in sin, the death of their race would have been the ultimate crime against creation, particularly if the destruction of such a superior species had been caused by the actions of an inferior race. Of course, the human progenitors of the baronial oligarchy had more than once nearly destroyed themselves. In decades past, the barons had warred against one another, each struggling for control and absolute power over territory. 10 barons survived the wars of territorial expansion and clawed out enclaves of civilization. More than 90 years before, 9 of them were summoned to the Ville of Front Royal to meet with a diplomatic envoy who outlined all the rewards that would be theirs if they put aside their differences, concentrated on their commonalities, and united. Barons had united before, observing trade agreements and non-aggression pacts. This proposal was different. A new form of government would be institutionalized in the baronies, and all the vills would be standardized according to pre-existing specifications. The barons would be provided with all the materials needed to achieve these goals, including a vast treasure trove of long-lost pre-dark technology, as pristine as the day it was manufactured. Not just a few boxes of ammo, or a couple of crates of guns, or the odd wag, but literally tons of materiel. Advanced weaponry, electronic equipment saved from electromagnetic pulses, even aircraft. All of it was in perfect operating condition. No longer would the individual barons be forced to cobble together electrical generators with spit and baling wire, or waste time with long periods of trial and error to figure out how to repair rusty engines. Moreover, they would be participating in a grand, radically new kind of social engineering. Over the following 4 generations, order was indeed restored to America. and the barons themselves represented the new order, as well as a new form of humanity. Only the barons themselves knew how different they were, not only from their human progenitors, from whom they had inherited their names and territories, but also from the humans they ruled. What made the barons so superior had little to do with the physical. The brains of the barons could absorb and process information with exceptional speed, and their cognitive abilities were little short of supernatural. But visceral emotions did not play a large part in the psychologies of the so-called new humans, the Homo superior. Complex human emotions like loyalty, self-sacrifice, and anger were complete mysteries to them. And though no one could argue that the hybrid race was as intellectually superior to humankind as the Cro-Magnon was to the Neanderthal, they paid a heavy price for their superior abilities. Compared to the old humans, they were fragile, their autoimmune systems at the mercy of infections and diseases that had little effect on the primitive apekin they ruled. Nor could they reproduce by intercourse. The nine barons were the products of in vitro fertilization, as were all hybrid offspring. Once a year, the oligarchy traveled to an installation beneath the Archuleta Mesa in Dulce, New Mexico, for medical treatments. Beneath the mesa, the barons received annual transfusions of fresh blood and a regimen of biochemical genetic therapy designed to strengthen their autoimmune systems, which granted them another year of life and power. When the renegade magistrates, Kane and Grant, had destroyed the critical medical facility beneath the mesa in New Mexico, it fell to the arrogant Baron Cobalt to suggest a means of reversing the flood tide of extinction lapping at the feet of the new humans. Baron Cobalt occupied Area 51 with the spoken assumption of taking responsibility to sustain his race, but only if he was elevated to a position of high authority, even above his fellow barons. Although Baron Cobalt had learned that Area 51's history was involved with rumors of alien occupation, he wasn't sure if the aliens referred to by the pre-dark conspiracy theorists were the Archons. More than likely they were, inasmuch as the equipment that still existed was already designed to be compatible with the hybrid metabolisms. In any event, Baron Cobalt reactivated the installation, turning it into a processing and treatment center without having to rebuild from scratch, and transferred the surviving human and hybrid personnel from the Dulce facility. But when Baron Cobalt dangled the medical treatments before his fellow barons, rather than share them freely, war was the inevitable result. Particularly after Sam, supported by Balaam, the last Archon, hijacked not only Cobalt's plan, but also the title of Imperator. The baronies had been poised on the brink of civil war, sparked by one of their own. But before that happened, Baron Cobalt's forces were violently displaced from Area 51, and he had disappeared. The doctrine of unity by which the baronies were formed had been decisively shattered. Baron Beausoleil had no idea what might take its place, but she knew she had to consolidate her position by forging a stronger link with the Imperator, which would, if all went according to her plans, help her establish supremacy over all the barons.